My base case is he got tired of talking for 6 months about how the U.S. wants to buy as much Bitcoin as it can. The U.S. wants to buy as much Bitcoin as it can, and then nothing happens.
If you willingly save in a system that you know with 100% certainty is stealing from you, there is something mentally wrong up here that you need to have checked.
They are just using their existing frame of reference, which is tiny and narrow in scope, to try and understand something which has never existed before, which is Bitcoin. Never had perfect money before.
If you want to talk about Bitcoin and you believe in it so much, you know, put your money where your mouth is and opt out. Not halfway, not a quarter of a way, opt out 100% and, you know, lead by example.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Bitcoin Banter. As always, I've got Tony and we've got a special guest, Walker. Walker America, thank you for joining, man. Let's jump right into the news. So up first, we have Bo Hines, the executive director of the White House Crypto Council, who recently refused to disclose how much Bitcoin the U.S. holds, is stepping down. Walker, I would love to hear your thoughts on what this means, why you think it's happened, the implications, anything else.
I mean, first of all, thanks for having me, guys. First on this, like the first thing that comes to mind is, man, Bo is clearly trying to be able to take advantage of being in the private sector for the largest generational bull run we're ever going to see. Can't blame the guy for that, right? Like he's, you know, young guy, wants to make his nut while he can. On the other hand, you have to wonder if there's some ideological reasons for stepping down. We haven't seen the Trump admin actually disclose the amount of Bitcoin that the U.S. has. The reason I can think of for that is that perhaps it is not as impressive as we were led to believe. Perhaps the Biden admin sold off more than we thought. Perhaps a lot of it was lost. Who can say? Moral of the story, I mean, I'm interested to see where Bo lands. I wouldn't be surprised if it was at a Bitcoin treasury company, to be honest. That just seems to be where everybody's going eventually here. So let's see what happens there. But I do think it's interesting. I think it could also be a result of maybe there's not as much movement as Bo wanted to see. He struck me as somebody who came out pretty gung-ho and pretty, you know, hardcore gunning for the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve. If he hasn't seen the movement that he wanted on that, perhaps he doesn't want to, you know, hang his hat on the work that's not going to get done. I still think the U.S. government is inevitably going to do this, but it's a question of when. And that when could take a little while. So I don't know. This could go either way here, but I have to imagine he's going to land at some pretty nice place in the private sector. You know, he's going to be taken care of just fine, I think.
I think I tend to agree with that. My base case is, I agree with you, he's going to end up somewhere nice in the private sector, if I were to imagine. But my base case is he got tired of talking for 6 months about how the U.S. wants to buy as much Bitcoin as it can. The U.S. wants to buy as much Bitcoin as it can, and then nothing happens. So I think he's frustrated or he's tired of saying the same thing with no action, but we'll see. Tony, what's your take?
Yeah, he strikes me as someone who is frustrated with lack of action. You know, he believed the marketing and the hype that everybody did, you know, initially. And he thought, you know, we're going to steamroll through this whole Bitcoin adoption thing. But, you know, 6 months later, it's nothing but, you know, just talk and no action. So either he got tired of it, or if you want to really be bullish, is that he knows something big is coming and he didn't want to be restricted as a government employee. And he, you know, opted out into the private sector because now he's going to set himself up, you know, to reap the benefits of like one of the biggest bull runs, you know, we have ever seen if things play out the way we expect them to. So it's a wait and see approach. I mean, the guy is definitely an intelligent human being. He's proven that, you know, numerous times. But I do get the sense that the frustration has played maybe a big part of his decision here. I mean, if I were in his shoes, I would probably, you know, feel, you know, like irked that, you know, what's stalling here, guys? You know, like we promised all these things. Why aren't we acting on it? And so just from a reputational point of view, I would jump ship as well and just, you know, do my own thing. So who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, I agree. All righty, guys, we've got the CBS segment was aired. I guess David Bailey was a guest. And one of the quotes as they were talking through this, trying to explain cryptocurrency, was that these cryptocurrencies are unlike hard currencies like the dollar or the euro. Thought we could all just have a little laugh here. It's interesting. Like, I see these mainstream segments on Bitcoin, and it, like, some of the FUD around energy usage and that use is sort of dissipated, but like they haven't really improved in quality. And like clearly misleading statements like this still feel like the norm. Tony, you experienced the worst of fiat currency in Lebanon. What would your message be to anyone who is under the impression that the dollar or the euro is a hard currency?
Man, I spit out my water when I heard that. You know, I was having a drink and I just spit it all out. I'm like, either these people are really off the chart stupid, or they think that everyone listening to them is dumber than dumber gets, right? So it's either one of the two. How would you, like any rational human being, utter such words that the euro or the dollar, you know, worthless money printed out of thin air by a bunch of Looney Tunes, has actual value, hard currency, backed by what exactly? A money printer? You know, it's complete lunacy. But, you know, like I said, either they're off the charts retarded, or they think the listeners, us, are, you know, who cares? You know, these dummies will believe anything we tell them. So it's laughable at best. I mean, anyone who has, you know, a shred ounce of understanding of money would dismiss this as complete, you know, it's a clown show.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Financial Times piece that, what was it, a couple months ago, the lady compared Bitcoin to her teeth because her teeth are also scarce, but they don't have value. So
that,
I don't know, Walker,
wild.
What do you think?
The teeth piece, I still can't, like, I'd forgotten about that. Like, I blocked it from my memory, thought it was just a strange dream. But yeah, now it's coming back to me in a terrible way. So I'll take the flip side from Tony, just for the sake of argument here. I can see why the, you know, fiat propagandists in the, you know, legacy media would call the dollar and the euro hard currencies, because they are hard currencies relative to every other shitcoin fiat out there, right? Like, you could say it's like saying, like, you know, oh wow, he's like, you know, saying some, you know, 300 pound person is like super skinny because they're at a fat camp, right? Like, they're at a fat camp with people who are 500 600 1000 pounds, so they're skinny relatively speaking. It's like, you know, it's the prettiest horse at the glue factory. Like, yeah, all these horses are about to get turned into glue, but like that one, it's got a pretty shiny coat on it. Like, looks pretty nice. So relatively speaking, sure, these are hard currencies. Neither of them are hard money, right? They're hard currencies in the sense that they are debased at a slightly lower rate than all of the other fiats in the world. But they're still getting debased really, really fast. And like, that's the thing. When they use these kind of terminologies, like saying, associating hard with any sort of fiat currency, Tony, I completely agree with you. Like, that is absurd. But it's because, like, they are fish swimming in the water, right? They don't know what this water is. They don't know what this money is. They are just using their existing frame of reference, which is tiny and narrow in scope, to try and understand something which has never existed before, which is Bitcoin. We've never had perfect money before. And so I get it when they say, like, well, these are hard currencies, because yeah, they're only stealing from you at 2% per year. Of course, they're actually stealing from you at like 6 to 7% per year, because that's the actual rate of monetary debasement. But hey, that's way too complicated for our idiot viewers to listen to. And we honestly don't even know how to talk about it ourselves. So anyway, catch that game last night, guys.
I was, Walker, I was going to start arguing with you to say that, no, what they should be comparing it to is Bitcoin. But actually, the segment was on crypto. And so even by that comparison, you could argue that the dollar and the euro are harder currencies than many, many cryptocurrencies. And this is where mainstream just needs to get through their head, Bitcoin, not crypto. That's going to be a long haul. So not even worth going there. Guys, we've got Harvard University capitulating, buying $120 million worth of Bitcoin. They should have said Bitcoin ETFs. Obviously, I don't think Harvard is taking self-custody of UTXOs. But this is a big capitulation. It's another mainstream institution. To me, this is signal, right? That, like, someone at Harvard is waking up and had the political power to push them into making a pretty big investment. So, Walker, I saw somewhere, I think this is bigger than their allocation to the gold ETFs. You said you thought it was more than a couple of other big names that they had invested in.
Yeah, I think you're right in the gold side. It's also more than what they have in Google or Nvidia. So, you know, you're looking at two of the most prominent companies in the world there. But it's also like, I think that's sized appropriately, right? If you look at Bitcoin's market cap, I mean, I think it's still a little bit behind Nvidia, right? But it's past Google at this point. It's past, you know, a lot of these Mag Sevens. It's chasing gold. Still got a little ways to go there, but that's part of the fun, right? But I think that this is a natural progression. It's like companies, endowments, you know, pension funds adopting Bitcoin as part of their holdings makes sense if Bitcoin is winning. And Bitcoin is winning, like it, very obviously so. And of course, anyone who is managing money, and especially significant amounts of money, who does not want to see the value of that continue to erode versus an actual measuring stick that makes sense, like Bitcoin, is going to want exposure to Bitcoin. And they're going to, the more they understand it, you know, I think like with all of us as individuals, the more we understand Bitcoin, the more we allocate to Bitcoin, the larger the percentage of Bitcoin versus our total net worth, it becomes over time as our own education increases. So I think that's what we're seeing here from Harvard. I think it's what we'll see from other endowments. We've seen it from different pension funds. I think the Wisconsin was maybe the first state pension fund to get exposure to Bitcoin. And honestly, I think this is great. Like, I mean, now there's a lot of things that Harvard could probably change on the educational side, but that's a different story, right? You know, maybe a little bit less communist propaganda, less Marx, more Mises, but you know, well, step by step.
A man can dream, that's for sure. Yeah. Tony, maybe this will be interesting. So I think they bought iBit, so it's a BlackRock's product, but Fidelity is working to allow for in-kind redemptions of Bitcoin for institutions. I'm curious, do you see on any short time horizon that a place like Harvard might actually convert into Bitcoin, to real Bitcoin, take self-custody, or is that just a pipe dream?
Well, look, it's like right now they're playing in the kiddie pool, right? Like, I mean, it wasn't that long ago where talking about Bitcoin will get you fired. Now we're headed towards, you know, not buying Bitcoin is going to get you massacred because, you know, it's the only logical play to stay afloat and to build, you know, actual value. How they're doing it now really doesn't matter. It's the fact that they are doing something with Bitcoin. That's the signal. And, you know, right now their actual allocation and how they're doing it is like a Mickey Mouse, you know, playing in the kiddie pool. But eventually, people will learn, will understand more. And at some point, I hope for their sake, self-custody becomes like the objective and they actually adopt it, learn the skills and do things properly, because that is the only way anyone, whether it's an individual or institution, will actually win in Bitcoin is when they hold their own keys. With, you know, killing the whole trust of third parties must happen. Otherwise, you are still living in the legacy mindset. That has to die for you to win in Bitcoin. And I think we're headed there.
I completely agree. All righty, we've got fun fact from Simply Bitcoin. No country has averaged under 2% inflation in the last 50 years. What happened in 1971? I think we all know. And so, Tony, you experienced, as I said, the worst of inflation. The currency collapse in Lebanon. The interesting thing is that the stats are always misleading, right? Like they throw out, I think, like an average debasement rate of like, I don't know, 12 or 13% globally. But what you really have are some people like the United States, to Walker's earlier point, benefiting from a relatively less bad currency. And you've got places that are just being absolutely crushed by hyperinflation on the other end of the spectrum. So Tony, you know what happened in 1971. You want to share your thoughts on this and what it means for people who you have firsthand experience. So Lebanon, but what's coming in the pipe down the pipeline for everyone else?
Well, for starters, if you believe government numbers, you might as well believe in Santa Claus because it's the same thing, right? There's no such thing as 2%. There never was. You know, at the very minimum, you're looking at double digits, and depending where you live, very high double digits. I experienced hyperinflation in real time. That is the most horrific thing anyone would ever want to go through, and I don't wish it on anyone. When you go from double digits to like 20 digits in like a matter of, you know, days, that is not something a lot of people recover from, because, you know, you literally have nothing to your name, and the paper that you thought was money is worth less than toilet paper. So the U.S. is in this very, you know, privileged position right now as a global reserve, access to the money printer. Yes, compared to other shit currencies, it's still the best one. But even its lifeline is, you know, expiring, and that expiration is accelerating. You know, it's not slowing down. So whether they, you know, they manage to kick the can a little bit further, I personally don't think they'll be able to do it for that much longer. But, you know, who knows? Either way, it's on a decline, and when it goes out, it's going to go out. You don't want to wait for that day to happen. So for anyone, you know, who wants to preserve any form of financial independence, you have to start looking at hard assets. And Bitcoin right now, it is the best play, in my opinion, that anyone should be looking at. It's not gold, not real estate. All of these things are highly manipulated, can be removed, can be stolen from you, unless, of course, you have an army to protect it, which almost nobody does. So learn the keys, learn how to protect them. Financial sovereignty is literally right here staring you in the face. You just need to act.
Walker, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, and Tony, I am sorry that the fiat overlord subjected you to hyperinflation in your life. And it's such an awful thing because it happens right in front of you, right? And you can literally watch it happening in real time, and it's happening fast, right? It's like gradually, then suddenly. And on the other side of this, though, I think what's especially dangerous for a lot of folks in the, you know, in the West, where we have, quote, you know, hard currencies, wink, wink, you know, stable fiats with just 2% inflation per year with their targeting. So they're telling you they're targeting 2% theft, but they don't frame it as theft. It's just necessary for growth, right? To juice the numbers. But the insidious thing about this is that over 50 years at 2% inflation, you lose something like 63% of your purchasing power. So that's 60. So you basically, your money buys around a third of what it did after 50 years, just from 2% inflation. But as you correctly pointed out, Tony, even not just places where there's hyperinflation, but just in normal inflation, I think the compound annual growth rate of the money supply in the U.S. is like 6 to 7%, give or take, per year. You take it from 71. If you take that, that means you're losing like 96 or 97% of your purchasing power over the course of 50 years. And so it's that slow creep. It's the fact that theft is being kind of hidden from you because you don't quite notice it. And also technology is improving so rapidly. Our productivity and efficiency gains are going so fast that you don't notice they're printing as much either. Because hey, at least flat screen TVs are getting cheaper, right? Because literally they can't outprint the deflation of technology when it comes to TVs. But this is the even more insidious thing, is that they're not stealing from you from a baseline of zero. Everything should be getting cheaper. Jeff Booth talks about this all the time. It's what his book, The Price of Tomorrow, is about. Technology is naturally deflationary. The baseline is that everything gets cheaper forever. So when everything gets more expensive forever, thanks to fiat inflation, that means that really they are stealing from a negative. So that 6 to 7% compound annual growth rate of the money supply, that's on top of maybe 3 to 4% deflation, natural deflation thanks to technology and prices. So they're stealing from you over 10% per year. And I mean, I just think that's disgusting. Like, you are literally stealing people's time and energy. Like, you are stealing their life. You are stealing the product of what they have worked hard for to save for their families for. That's criminal in my mind. Like, No man should have complete control of the money printer, right? And that's why I'm so grateful Bitcoin exists, because we've finally taken the money printer out of the hands of humans, right? And put it in cyberspace and established a set of rules that we can all agree on. And it's rough and it's messy, but it works. And I think if we didn't have that, the world would be a much darker looking place right now. But as it is, I've got hope because Bitcoin exists.
You know what's the more infuriating thing, Walker, based on exactly what you said? Is that a lot of people, including Bitcoiners, know this, yet they willingly remain in the fiat system. They save money in a bank. They comply with these rules. They're too afraid to break away completely, even though they talk about Bitcoin all day long, right? But when you ask them, do you live on a Bitcoin standard? And you scratch the surface, it's very clear that a lot of them do not. And to me, that's hypocritical. Because Bitcoin was created for the separation of money and state. If you want to talk about Bitcoin and you believe in it so much, you know, put your money where your mouth is and opt out, not halfway, not a quarter of a way, opt out 100% and, you know, lead by example. Because otherwise, like, what are you doing? You know, like, first of all, the truth will be uncovered very quickly. No one's, like, there's a lot of intelligent people out there that will see right through you. And Like, you're not helping anyone. So for us, as far as we're concerned, we're very consistent in that message. If you want to live on a Bitcoin standard, first of all, you need to study Bitcoin. This is not a get-rich-quick scheme. Study what it is. As soon as you understand it, you're going to see that your allocation to it will go from 1 to maybe 100 by yourself much quicker than you realize. Because if you willingly save in a system that you know with 100% certainty is stealing from you, there is something mentally wrong up here that you need to have checked. And this is what I find infuriating, that so many people, even though they know this, they are incapable of completely breaking free. It's like a very bad drug addiction. It's almost like inexplainable.
I never tell anyone what to do with their money as a general rule. But what I will say is that I think fiat is great for spending, and it's great for spending in the fiat world. Right. It's not great for saving. You shouldn't be saving in fiat. But if you want to have like a rainy day emergency fund of fiat that you may need, because unfortunately 99.9% of the world still operates in fiat. Yeah, I think that's a prudent thing to do. I think the most important thing to do, though, is to make sure that you have your future savings. That should be denominated in Bitcoin. It should be in Bitcoin. You should also look at, the opportunity cost of what you're doing from a Bitcoin lens. Because that's, I think, the biggest problem that people run into. I don't have a problem with people still using fiat. I still use fiat because I need to for various things, right? I try to spend Bitcoin as much as I can. I save in Bitcoin. That is my savings account, right? But I do still spend fiat because I need to for various things. Because shockingly, not everyone in the world accepts Bitcoin yet. But what I think is really important is to make sure that when you're viewing the world, you do it through the Bitcoin lens. You do it through the lens of, this is my measuring stick, because fiat's a terrible measuring stick. And I think what the trap that I see a lot of Bitcoiners still fall into is they look at Bitcoin and they're measuring it in dollars still. When, why would you measure it? You want to measure it in which dollars? The United States, Australian, Canadian dollars? Should we measure it in pesos? Like, which of these broken fiat measuring sticks do you want to use? I don't think you should use any of them. Bitcoin is repricing all of these fiat measuring sticks because it is the only fixed measuring stick. It's the only one that retains its actual dimensions. It's the only one that allows you to make genuine economic calculations long into the future. And so that's the shift I try to push people to see, is that, you know, you're going to need to spend fiat, like realistically. Like, I'm sure you've still made some fiat payments recently for various things. Like, you may have had to, you know, but as long as you have that mentality shifted of, I'm measuring my world through Bitcoin. I'm using Bitcoin as my savings vehicle for long into the future. And yeah, I still need to spend some fiat, and I keep a little bit in a rainy day fund in case I absolutely need it. But boy, I try to be as short fiat as possible. Then I think you're on the right path and you're doing okay. Because everybody's different too. Everybody has different different tolerances, different needs. And depending on where you live, different requirements for how you need to interact with the fiat world.
Well said, gents. Alrighty. Up next, we've got $50 billion Jack Dorsey's Block just announced it's going to launch American-made Bitcoin mining chips next week. So I'll just give my commentary. This, to me, is exciting just because I think we need decentralization, diversification of hardware manufacturers and mining. Same way we need more mining pools who are not, you know, the 50% of basically operating under the same umbrella. Tony, I'll let you take this one first. What do you think?
No, definitely good news, man. I mean, the more variety and options that we have out there, the better. I just hope they're able to scale it, you know, large enough to keep prices, you know, within a reasonable range, so that, you know, that doesn't de-incentivize people from adopting it. But it's definitely a move in the right direction, and I hope it takes off.
So Walker, you had some sort of an interesting thought on how this could play out in the U.S., especially with a Trump administration that has been heavily involved in American made and, you know, all that stuff. What do you think is likely to happen in the coming years with this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think this is a great thing. It's great that we have are going to have the capability to do this in America, and that we're not going to be solely reliant on Chinese manufacturers for this, because that is obviously a threat factor. I think that is very much going to be the position as well of the Trump administration, and hopefully any administration to follow. Like, Bitcoin does have national security implications, and it it kind of changes that national security paradigm in ways that are probably a little bit too complex for us to get into right now. But the point being, I think the Trump administration is going to look at this and say, okay, I mean, you could very easily see them saying, maybe we need to subsidize the Bitcoin, you know, ASIC chip industry. Like maybe we need to throw some subsidies behind that. I'm personally against all government subsidies as they are market distortions, but that's a different story. They're going to keep subsidizing, unfortunately, because this is the fiat world. But I could very much see them also saying, you know what, if America's going to be the Bitcoin superpower of the world, then we need to make sure we own the supply chain here in America. And we need to make sure that our American miners are using American-made chips and that is all vertically integrated right here in the good old US of A. So who knows? We could see a very interesting dynamic at play here where American miners are incentivized by the government to purchase American-made chips. And again, not a fan of subsidies, but they're going to happen because this is fiat world, unfortunately. But we'll see. Either way, I think it's I don't think that Jack is going to be begging for subsidies by any means. And I think it's great what they're doing here. We should decentralize, as you said, decentralize as much of this, mining ecosystem as possible, from the chips to the pools to the templates. Like, that all needs to be as broken down as possible. Right now, it's, you know, a worrisome trend in the direction of centralization. But I think this is a step in the right direction back toward decentralization.
Yeah, well said. Speaking of worrisome trends, Monero, it looks like they are being 51% attacked. So Cubic just reached 51% mining share of Monero. So this is something the Monero guys have been, and understand that there are a lot of cypherpunks out there who appreciate Monero for its privacy properties. However, what the code says is very distinct from how secure the network is, right? And so like your ability to transact privately on Monero is contingent upon a secure network, or at least for the ability for it to be useful. So I think to me, this is a warning for anyone who's dabbling in crypto, trying to figure all this out. Historically, I think Bitcoiners have probably sympathized with Monero more than other cryptocurrencies, whether they like it, use it or not. And I'll just say, I don't. Tony, what would your message be to people who are seeing this news? Like, is this a risk to all crypto? Is this a risk just to Monero? Why Bitcoin only? And anything you want to elaborate on here?
Well, listen, first off, I don't want to see Monero fail, okay? So, I mean, the true decentralization can only exist in Bitcoin as far as I'm concerned. And of course, you know, events like this, you know, ultimately prove it. That being said, I do believe that privacy coins have a specific and much needed use case, more so depending where you live, you know, in this world. So, but I don't know enough technicals about Monero to debate this on that level. Superficially, I don't like this, that this is taking place. I hope somehow it works out favorably. But it's just the underlying message. You know, there's only Bitcoin and then there's everything else. If you want to protect your financial generational wealth, don't gamble with it. You know, trust the network that has the most usage, that's the most decentralized, proven over 16 years plus now, and is only getting stronger every 10 minutes. So that's pretty much what I have to say on this.
Yeah. Walker, I think you sort of take maybe another side of this debate. What's your take on everything going on with Monero?
Look, I think it's a noble goal to have as much privacy as possible. Like, and for folks that disagree with that and say, why do you need privacy if you have nothing to hide? Kindly go fuck yourself. Pardon my French. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear in this show, so apologies. But you know, again, it's a noble goal. Like, we should want that. The difficulty is that Monero is obviously vulnerable. Like, it does not have the network effect that Bitcoin does. Protocols are a winner take most, or, you know, basically winner take all situation. There's one internet. Now, you could debate about how the internet's cloistered off in different parts of the world, whatever. But generally, there's one internet protocol that is widely used by essentially everyone. That's going to be the case with a monetary protocol as well, right? And so, yeah, it's great that Monero was providing a different sort of use case for a private currency for transfers, but it's just not feasible in the long term because it's not going to have the security behind it that Bitcoin does, not even orders and orders of magnitude less. The other thing is that all of the privacy preserving technology that Monero was providing You can get that with eCash on Bitcoin. Like with Cashew, with Fediments, you now have near perfect privacy. And yes, there are trade-offs. Like there are trade-offs with using Monero. Like for example, if you use Monero, your chain could get reorged because there's a 51% attack, like is happening literally right now. There are trade-offs with eCash where, yes, a mint could rug you. But if a mint rugs you, it has to rug everyone. It can't selectively rug you. You can also use a bunch of different mints. Fedimint also provides another really interesting piece of this puzzle, which is, you know, kind of that federated model, which is distributing that a little bit and creating more opportunities for, I think, hyper-local organization of funds, which is great. And again, these are black boxes. Like nobody can see in there. This is near perfect privacy because nothing's absolutely perfect, right? So I would encourage people, if you need to transact as privately as possible, check out eCash. There's a ton of incredible stuff being built on there right now. Callie, who built Cashew, the protocol, is doing incredible stuff. And there's a bunch of other open source devs building amazing tools. These tools are available right now. They're sending eCash tokens over BitChat, the Jack Dorsey's Bluetooth mesh network. Like, that's amazing. You're sending near perfect privacy preserving eCash tokens that are bearer instruments across Bluetooth with no internet to other people, and nobody needs to know anything about anyone else. Like that's incredible. So like the cypherpunk vision of having near perfect privacy, and when it comes to electronic cash, that exists, and it exists on a Bitcoin layer. And there are trade-offs, but again, like there are trade-offs with everything. If you want uncensorable, unconfiscatable, unruggable money, use Bitcoin layer one. If you want near perfect privacy and, you know, instant transfer with no delay whatsoever, you use eCash. And so I'm very bullish on the builders that are putting out all of this incredible work on these layer twos and threes of Bitcoin, because this is ultimately like how money scales. It does it in layers. And it's the mistake that, you see folks like the Solana corporation making, where they think, no, it all needs to happen on layer one. We just need to make layer one really fast. But the problem is that you make trade-offs then for decentralization and security. And so Bitcoin made those trade-offs. They made the trade-off to not have speed in the base layer. But we have speed on all the other layers. And still, it settles for final settlement that can't be rugged. I think Bitcoin is still undefeated, even on the base layer. So,
yeah, no, well said. If you're looking into crypto, just do yourself a favor, get some Bitcoin, take self-custody, ignore everything else. All righty, guys, last one, just for fun. So Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin, launches Bitcoin payments for trips to space. My sense is he is catering to the crypto bros who got in early and just made millions or billions. I don't know, but pretty cool though that you've got like a mainstream brand people have heard of doing some interesting things, now accepting Bitcoin payment. Tony, what's your take?
It would be cool if he only offers return tickets to those who pay in Bitcoin, you know, and a one-way trip to everybody else. Look, man, you know, all roads lead to Bitcoin, and the more people accept it in whichever shape, way, or form, you know, it is, then it's bullish news, man. So why not? I'd like to see him accept Amazon starting to accept Bitcoin payments. That would be huge.
That would be beautiful. That would be beautiful. But it's interesting, though, that he clearly recognizes a use case, and he recognizes a desire for certain people to use it. And so my hope is maybe he's inching closer in that direction, because that's my biggest fiat problem is Amazon, I would say, or at least my wife's biggest fiat problem, Walker.
I would just go ahead and get some Amazon gift cards on Fold. At least then you can still stack some sats while you purchase those gift cards.
There you go.
At least there's that. And I know there's a bunch of other companies that do it as well, but I mean, I think this is just an interesting cultural moment, right? It's like you can buy a ticket to space, or, you know, kind of near Earth orbit, but like, yeah, space with Bitcoin. Like, that's pretty cool that you can use magic internet money to do that. And I mean, you're definitely right that they are catering to whales, because I know they had a Blue Origin, like, boot or not booth. They had one of their pods, one of their shuttles, you know, at the Bitcoin conference in Vegas. Like, I went in there and, you know, like, just asked the guy just to see how far out of my price range it was, you know. And I'm like, what does this cost? He's like, well, when you sign the NDA, I can tell you exactly how much it costs. But right now I can tell you it's between $1 million and $5 million. And I'm like, all right, see you later. Thanks for letting me tour this. Maybe I'll come back in a couple of halving cycles when this is the price has deflated in Bitcoin terms.
That's right. Awesome. Well, guys, this is a fun one. Walker, thanks so much for joining us, man. Why don't you give everyone a handoff? Tell them where they can find you and your podcast.
Sure. Thanks for having me, guys. This was a blast. Love to do it again anytime. You can find me on Noster at primal.net/walker, podcast at primal.net/titcoin. You can go to bitcoinpodcast.net and find all the links. I'm Walker America on X, at Titcoin Podcast on X. You can search The Bitcoin Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and find my show there. And yeah, stoked to be here. And go check out, download yourself an eCash wallet and enjoy some of that near-perfect privacy while you're at it. That's what I'd also like to show. And I'm not paid by any open-source eCash developers, just to clarify.
Awesome. Good send-off, man. For everyone else, thanks for tuning in. Take another minute to listen to a bit about the Bitcoin way. We'd love to chat with you. Gents, great chatting. Walker, hope to see you again soon, man.
That was awesome. Thanks, guys.
Cheers. Hey there. Thank you for tuning in to Bitcoin Banter. Wanted to take a quick minute to remind you to head on over to thebitcoinway.com/podcast to schedule a free 30-minute consultation with a member of our team. It is critical that you take full control of your wealth, and we can equip you with the skills needed to take 100% self-custody of your Bitcoin. For our existing clients, we also offer our Bitcoin Bootcamp, where we will conduct quarterly calls with you to reinforce the training we've provided and fill any gaps in your knowledge. While you're at it, ask about our solo mining service, something we think everybody should be doing. We also help with addressing your personal and online cybersecurity, and we can even help you set up a privacy phone free of big tech and Big Brother surveillance. Don't underestimate the amount of tracking taking place in your browser and in the apps you use every day. And finally, whether you're ready to make a move to a freedom-loving paradise or want a backup in the event of a worst-case scenario, be sure to ask about our Plan B residency program. Being untethered from a single location is one of the best ways to ensure your self-sovereignty into the future. Again, you can schedule a free consultation at thebitcoinway.com/podcast. If you are enjoying the show, please do me a favor, subscribe to our channel wherever you listen, give us a 5-star review, and drop us a comment. We would really appreciate it, and it makes it easier for others to begin finding us as we preach the gospel of financial self-sovereignty and beyond. Thank you again for listening. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.